Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back. And it is now or never. And happy Memorial Day. As a matter of fact, we're going to do kind of a special glance at war. And more importantly, what we're going to dive into, because it's Monday. And, you know, the one song that actually comes to mind, because it seems like every week we're making a very special effort in bringing you critical content. Feedback Friday is really, you know, the day for, you know, where I get feedback, and actually I've got some feedback to share regarding, you know, my first Monday presidential presentation for you. If I was president, this is what I would do. And as a matter of fact, this presidential election episode series that we're doing, these episodes are designed to give you the constitutional view of what the president should be doing, period. And if you really want to make America great once and for all, then this is what has to happen, folks. This is what we have to do. to be clear, there's war coming. There is going to be war with China. But I honestly believe that is not going to be that critical. Because if America actually does what we need to do, the whole world will be dealing with a hurt locker on, you know, the calamities that the Lord has coming. Because, folks, we're going to see the most tumultuous times coming up. They don't call it the great and dreadful day of the Lord, you know, and it's all those diverse earthquakes. I mean, it's going to get bad. There's going to be a lot of people that are going to die. And we already know some of the ways and so forth of how they're going to die. But bottom line, because that massive carnage hasn't really started, you know, people, I want you to fathom this. Let's just say the accurate count of the population on Earth is 9 billion people. And the Bible basically says that 2/3 of the earth will die. Well, this makes math really easy. This means that 6 billion people will die, because that's 2/3 of 9 billion. And so if you look at the time span, that is the most carnage ever to happen on the face of the earth. Get yourselves right. Get yourselves right with God, folks. We got to get this nation right too. And I can't say there's no way of healing it spiritually, because Christ can truly do that. But my point is that there's no way that we could actually invoke, you know, one faith or another. We actually have to come together. We have to put aside our differences and basically embrace the same principles, the laws of nature and nature's God that the framers embraced, and not worry about, you know, who this person is. You know, judge people by their works and, you know, judge them by what they're doing. You know, I run into people that, you know, as a matter of fact, I was asked not too long ago, would I have a problem with somebody that was an alcoholic or had a drinking problem? You know, we kind of, it always starts off with this really drastic situation, but we kind of narrow it down to somebody that is functioning in life. Would I have a problem having that person serve as long as they were doing their job? No. I don't care if they were, you know, if they were indulging in drugs. I really don't care. I don't. As long as they're doing their job right. Right? I mean, we're getting to that point in society. And this conversation actually kind of took off because employers are in this position now. Employers, you know, they can't actually, now that marijuana has become legalized, And see, I know a lot of people that really hate smoking, you know, this concept of smoke. It's just bad. Smoking anything is bad. So why would we consider smoking pot good or puffing it or what have you? But are you okay with them eating it then? I mean, that's almost the same as drinking then, right? It places a new context to where, okay, people are consuming by eating their cannabis instead of drinking alcohol. Do you have a problem with that? You know, in other words, because alcohol actually kills brain cells. Now, we don't know all of the damages because, I mean, THC and pot's been around for a few decades, but they haven't done a lot of studies. But bottom line, you're not causing, you know, the harm on your lungs and those types of problems by breathing it in. Anyway, so back to this quick conversation. I really don't care what you're doing. I don't care even if you are not active or, you know, a good... because remember, Thomas Jefferson was kind of excoriated for him not being a good member of their community, or I should say a faithful Christian attending church in good standings, because that was the concept. In good standing, you had to be attending church on a regular basis. If you weren't, then you really lost your good standing. In other words, back in those days, they kind of had a social credit system that the only way they could tell whether you were good is whether you were going to church. And Thomas Jefferson hated this because he was a very religious man. And he, you know, he thought he was going down a more pure path of religion. And he, and in essence, I mean, anyway, I don't want to get into all of this, but what I want to just kind of back out of this rat hole as effectively as I possibly can with this one message. The only thing that really should matter is whether people are maintaining their oath of office in public service. If they are abiding by the law of the land and they are doing what they're doing, you may have a problem with their, you know, their attitude. You may have a problem with, you know, just them being mean, you know, or what have you, or being, you know, non-personal. I mean, there's a lot of people that have problems with me just because I'm not that personable. In other words, even some family members, just, you know, I'm always down to business. I never take the time to be tender and loving and caring that they would need or that they'd like, because they're needy. And that's okay. There's nothing wrong with being needy until it actually starts affecting you. And so anyway, my point is that what really matters is, you know, not how you're living or those types. I mean, it matters. We want to help those people. We want to get people to, as right as we possibly can. But what we should really care about, who is in the fight, where they are in the fight, and so forth, we just should only care about what they're doing in the fight. And so I know that there's, you know, this concept of not judging and so forth, but let me just kind of move out of this, because we do have a special glance at war, like I told you. And as a matter of fact, I saw this interesting meme that had, you know, from the American Revolution through the Vietnam and I think Iraq, you know, the two Iraq wars. And as I looked at that, I go, wow, that's interesting that there's no civil war on that. You know, because they're calling out a lot of things that weren't really wars. Vietnam was not a war. As a matter of fact, we never declared war in many of these circumstances. And as a matter of fact, maybe the House of Representatives, but we never totally declared war, I think, since World War II. So when we look at, you know, what we call war and memorials, I know that there are people that die in their service. And the whole point of the thing, you know, this meme, you know, I think was, you know, to recognize those who had died in the service of their country. And so the interesting point that I want to make is regarding the Civil War. I think that the reason why people avoid the Civil War, and it's usually those who have radical views. Now, they may be radical as far as racially radical. They may be progressive radical or what have you, because you can find people racially radical in any camp, right? But the progressives tend to dominate this theater. They tend to, you know, this is their narrative. And what I wanted basically take this one quick moment of time is to recognize the fact that the Civil War was evidence of God's hand in America. Now, it was Mason who stated in the Constitutional Convention, because they refused to get rid of slavery and they allowed slavery to be perpetuated into this new government, that he said the petty tyrants, you know, slave owners are always petty tyrants. And he said, because God can't punish nations and states in heaven, he will punish this nation and these states here on earth for us keeping and maintaining slavery. Now, we've also read through the ratification debates. Just recently, we have read through how the Northern ratification debates were really explaining how mathematically the institution of slavery would be done away with. And I actually helped point out the fact of that, that the fact was that slavery, based on the Constitution, was on its way out. And it was only the progressives, again, the Democrats, again, were the ones that actually created the gag rule on slavery, and they were the ones that created the Missouri Compromise. They were the ones that, you know, were perpetuating slavery. And so when we look at information, you know, we have to kind of put things into perspective, but when you find that there is this real dark aura and a bunch of misinformation regarding not just slavery, but the Civil War more specifically, because everybody was doing slavery. Every nation was either respecting it and or supporting it and or embracing it. And so it was America that ended it, period. There wasn't any nation that actually was committed to the equality of mankind more than America. And so, we've got all sorts of credentials. But bottom line, when we look at why there's all of this misinformation, because people do not want you to ultimately come around to the knowledge that our Civil War was tantamount to the freeing of Israel from slavery. And I say this because God had his hand in both of those actions. Remember, slavery throughout the world, and I've said this before, slavery has always ran its course. In other words, as all of these big acts of slavery, the Chinese Wall, the Taj Mahal, all of these big edifices that were built that were done based on slavery, well, when the big tasks were done, slavery kind of went away. Or I shouldn't say it went away, but the mass number of people that were enslaved reduced back to a normal and let everybody kind of go and do their thing. Now, these two cases of Israel and the Civil War, God played his hand in. And this is why historians want to distort this, because they don't want you to see his hand. And that is the special view I want to give you on warfare, because there have been times, and in this nation, we have seen his hand, and many times he has required that we shed our blood for liberty. Now, here's the question, because it's now or never. Are you going to be subjugated, or are you going to have to shed your blood for liberty, or are you going to look at his gift of this Constitution and the supreme law of the lands and say, we don't need to shed blood again. We can actually take a stand and enforce this Constitution and free us from the chains and shackles of Britain and the world, of this globalist communist agenda. And so, yes, folks, we have the way forward. So anyway, that's my, you know, special glance at war. But happy Monday, happy Memorial Day. Hopefully you had a good reflection of those who have you know, passed on. In because I mean, the show airs at the end of the day here. And so, you know, hopefully by now you have at least had some reflection on that ultimate cost that so many have given in serving their country. And there's a lot of people, you know, they call it acquiring or appropriating, you know, when somebody tries to act black or what have you. And so there's these people that, oh, well, those who, you know, are first responders who died in saving lives, what the first responders, folks, are not people who actually, you know, volunteered to go die. First responders may die in the act of doing something, but they did not go into where, you know, it was almost certain death. D-Day was certain death. Being a, you know, an ambulance driver or a fireman and so forth. I mean, there's a huge difference. As a matter of fact, I have a real problem with compensation for first responders, the amount of money that they get in contrast to the military. Those active duty guys, you're telling me that they deserve dirt? Anyway, we need to get our heads right. But if we were actually doing what we should be doing, we wouldn't need the size of a military other than the Navy. So we're going to actually get into that in the presidential campaign. So I'm hoping that you stick out this whole show and you listen to these Monday shows where we cover these. This is a special day because it's Memorial Day. But the next week, we won't have any reason to divert or what have you. But what we want to do is give you a good view of what a true constitutional president would be doing and the positions that they would be taking, period. Okay, so we're going to just dive forward. And actually, what I want to do, because I I would like to do a quick review as to why, you know, I said some of the things I said. Now, I told you, and actually, what I've, part of this, some feedback that I got. So a part of, because this is from Matt, he would like to actually see me cite the Constitution as we kind of do this. So I'm going to do that. So as we talked about, the president must care and ensure that the laws are faithfully executed. Well, where does that come from? Well, that actually comes from Article 1, Section 1. And actually, no, it's Article 2, Section 2. This is his oath. This is the president's oath. I do solemnly swear or affirm that I will faithfully execute the office of the president, and I will do my best of ability preserve, preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States. I'm just trying to paraphrase, but I'm actually citing here. Then, in the next section, it says that the president, he shall take care that the laws be faithfully executed and shall commission all officers of the United States. So the most important job of the president is to ensure that the Constitution and all laws in pursuant to it are being followed. The problem is we have very few laws that are in pursuant to the Constitution anymore. Most of them have been all deviated and perverted in such a bad way. So this is why we really dove into this concept of, and I'll just say, definitizing the Constitution, why that's all important. Because we need the states to actually do what the president's supposed to do and faithfully execute the laws of the union and ensure full compliance to the Constitution. So what we've also kind of covered is what I would say is the the apportionment. Now, when I covered the apportionment, that it was 30,000 people, the actual constitutional reference is Article 1, Section 1, and this is what it says. The number of representatives shall not exceed one for every 30,000, but each state shall have at least one representative. Okay, so the other thing is, and I can't emphasize this enough, because this is the Supremacy Clause. The Constitution and the laws of the United States, which shall be made in pursuance thereof, or based upon the actual Constitution, and all treaties made, or which shall be made under the authority of the United States, shall be the supreme law of the land. Now, the key part of the treaties is under the authority. If the Constitution does not grant the authority, then they can't make a treaty. In other words, any treaty that has been made that the federal government did not have that specific authority to subjugate us, like to the UN. It's one thing to make a treaty regarding the commerce and trade. Yes, they can do that. But they cannot put us into a global government that we are going to be subjugated to. They have no authority to do that. We are sovereign states, and the United States government is absolutely charged with the responsibility of protecting the sovereignty of the states and the sovereignty of this nation, period. So we kind of went through all of these different things, and so at this point in time, I kind of talked about, the next thing I talked about was the 17th Amendment. That's where we really landed, or we ended up. And so at this point in time, I started off, and this is where I was going into this, is that as the President of the United States, I would advise the states that those states that have not consented to the 17th Amendment must go back to appointing their senators whether they want to or not. Because Article 5 clearly says this, and see, this is why going into these citations, it really helps. Provided that no amendment which shall be made, dot, 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 because it's, actually, I'll go ahead and read this part. Made prior to the year 1808 shall in any manner affect the first and fourth clauses of the ninth section of the first article, which is the article of shutting down the slave trade, and that no state without its consent shall be deprived of its equal suffrage in Senate. So in other words, even if they're willing to deprive themselves today, they can't. It says right here, no state without its consent. So in other words, they have to either give a consent or they have to actually have the state legislatures appoint their senators. So either they ratify that amendment or they stop running elections. So as the president, I would go to Florida, Georgia, Kentucky, Mississippi, South Carolina, Virginia, and Utah and tell them, quit violating the Constitution. You cannot have general elections for your senators. You must consent to doing that, or you must actually follow Article let me see here. It's Article 1, and I think it's Section 3, where the Senate, it talks about the senators. And so I would advise them that the 17th Amendment can only legally restrict those who ratified it. Those who did not ratify it cannot be legally restricted. And in other words, they can't even do anything different. They have to follow because they rejected it. Did not give consent, they actually have to follow what is still in the Constitution. In other words, that amendment can't force all states. It can't be a three-fourths. It has to be 100%. And so talk about the divine hand of providence in giving us an amendment to protect state sovereignty. Anyway, we'll be right back after this promo. Thank you so much.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Okay, so getting back into my job as president or whoever's president, they also have to, completely communicate or help the states understand, poke them in the eye, that they no longer have to do their apportionment based on population. Remember, when I talked about apportionment in the last session or in last week, I was basically focused on telling Congress that Congress could not, maintain the existing apportionment, that they are going to need to change the budget for Congress, not to increase it, but they have to reallocate it, because some of the things that are going to change is the fact that the House of Representatives will no longer use that part of the Capitol for all of their meetings and their session. The only reason that they'll actually have to come in is if Congress actually has a legitimate, an investigation where they're going to actually question people for violating their oath of office, all of that type of stuff. Remember, we kind of zoned in on this whole focus of what Congress, your paradigm shifting. And so you're going to have to reallocate most of your budget, and you're no longer going to become residents of D.C., at least the House of Representatives. Okay, so anyway, so I will basically then, or the president should basically then inform the states that they're no longer going to be able to apportion their, current number of people to representatives, that they'll have to go back to the 30,000 representatives. And so they'll have to redraw their Congress, their congressional districts. And there's a good likelihood, folks, because when you really think about this, what's the size? What's the minimum size of most counties throughout the United States population-wise? It's over 30,000, I can tell you that. As a matter of fact, so each county will then have to share one of its representatives with another county, but they will have one body or a single representative at a minimum in most of these counties. There'll be some counties that will have to share, but that's okay. Anyway, then I'll advise the states that if they use a majority, in other words, within their constitution, they use a majority voting to actually amend their constitution. In other words, 50% plus one. Then this is a democracy rule that they cannot continue. In other words, as the president, for them to actually conduct amendments of their own constitution, so I'm going to go to Article 4. Because as the president, I have to make sure that the laws are being executed and faithfully followed. So when we look at Article 4, Section 4, it says that the United States shall guarantee to every state of this union a republican form of government.
So in other words, every state constitution's amendment process cannot be done by a majority. That it must be done, it can be done by a majority of counties. It can be done by a a supermajority, and that would be my recommendation, but that every state must at a minimum, get rid of the popular vote and democracy and move towards either a majority. If, you know, you have a majority of counties, whatever that requires based on your state makeup. Now, my advisement to these states would be that they increase that majority to something very significant. And when I say significant, I mean like 3/4, just like the United States Constitution. As a matter of fact, the best rule of thumb is to just use the U.S. Constitution as your template for setting up your state governments. Oh, well, people go, well, hold on here. The U.S. Constitution wouldn't give this, you know, the ability to regulate all the commerce and so forth at the state level. That's correct. I would recommend that you make your state a general government to serve the counties, and that you would allow the counties to basically determine what type of commerce and those types of things that they feel is best. In other words, we don't want the state to basically start dictating that this is how you're going to conduct business, or this is the type of business you can conduct, or the types of, you know, resources or what have you. That the counties need to actually protect most of their rights and powers from the state, from being able to centralize and start manipulating the state and, more specifically, the counties. So anyway, the next thing I would do as the president of the United States is I would advise the states that all judicial verdicts and opinions that were not within the enumerated RRPPs, roles, responsibilities, powers, and properties of the United States Constitution, or the Constitution for the United States, such as marriage, abortion, apportionment, all these things that they've just created, the Electoral College, labor laws, all of these different things that they've just mandated through these court decisions, such as your counties and the reforming your government. They don't have any authority to do that. And so, therefore, my advisement is that they actually start scrubbing those books to identify what they are. And then my advice would then be that they must take and stand and enforce the Constitution by basically, and the best way to do this is to actually go through to find out what these court rulings are and what these, well, actually, initiate the Republic review process to dissolve all unconstitutional laws made by Congress, made by the judiciary, and made by the executive. Now, the judiciary is through their rulings to create laws. They can't do that. They have no legislative authority. And the president using executive orders to create laws is also unconstitutional. So the only way a law can actually be handed to the states is, one, it has to come from the Congress, and two, it has to be in pursuant to the Constitution. In other words, if it's a law that's based on something that is not an enumerated role, responsibility, power, or property, then they can't give that law to the states. It's that simple. Then I would direct the House and the Senate to prepare to work from their state with secure comms and actually tell them to actually start expanding the national security interest into state legislative bodies so that they have communications, in other words, crypto communications, and sensitive compartmented information facilities in each state that are, you know, that are not, okay, so I'm going to say this as well, that are not already in operation on a military faculty or facility. So bottom line, if in a state like California has several military facilities that actually have SCIFs, that actually have the comms and everything else to be able to provide for that national level security, for those conversations and so forth. And they're all over the place. They're down in San Diego. They're up north in Sacramento area. I think Beale is up there. So if you have a state that has military facilities, then you don't necessarily need that. But actually, some of these bases will be getting closed because we'll get into that. But bottom line, those resources that may be there, like the SCIF or the comms, that the stuff that's movable can be moved. If not, then there's no reason why the state can't actually assume that as state property, so that that's where their Congress people can actually sit, meet, and do their job. Now, keep in mind that the whole point of the District of Columbia was to make sure that one state couldn't harass their, the representatives from other states or what have you. That's not required anymore if everybody is working from their own state, because it's not like they're going to somebody else's state to work. So to be clear, there's going to be a reallocation as we start looking at all of these things that are going to be, I'll just say, scuttled. We don't need so many people employed by the federal government. The only reason for doing that, and the cost of doing that, creates a burden for the people. We don't need this. And so what we can do is we can actually start reallocating. As a matter of fact, there's no reason why some of these things can't be actually packed up and sent out to the states without them. There's no doubt in my mind that there's plenty of resources and there's plenty of I'll just say, equipment, hardware, facilities, what have you, that can probably be packed up and reallocated to a state that may not have it. So the next thing I would do as the president of the United States, if I was the president, I would inform the states that as president, now I'm informing the states that as the president of the United States, I will stand down the federal standing armies from harassing them and enforcing unconstitutional laws. In other words, the BLM, they will actually start packing up and they'll actually start getting prepared to, come back, and we'll stop enforcing these. And unfortunately, many of these people will be laid off because most of the stuff that they're doing is not within the Constitution. So I'll be probably laying a lot of these people off. Now, here's the thing. These people could easily, if they've kept their nose clean and they've had great relations with the people in the states, then they should easily be able to find a job right there in the states to kind of to do those things that the state may need. Bottom line, the ATF, the CDC, the Health and Human Services, bureaucracies out there, all the little things that they're doing, the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, all of these different standing armies that are coming, they're running around with clipboards and guns, IRS, all of these things, they will no longer be used to harass you enforcing the laws. We will actually be shifting all law enforcement back to the militia, the way it is supposed to be in accordance with the Constitution. That's the intent here, folks. That's how it has to go. And that's how it's going to go down. So, in other words, all domestic commerce, national health care, bureaucracies, enforcements, inspections, labor, energy, agriculture, housing, interior, like I just said, the BLM, education regulation enforcement, parks and forests, federally protected habitats within the states, all of these types of federal functions within the state will be suspended. All of these states must then begin. So I'm doing this as the president for my 4 years in office. These people will be suspended. In other words, they're not functioning in the states to enforce laws that are unconstitutional. So what we're going to do is we're going to then poke the states in the eyes and tell them that they must terminate these powers, these unconstitutional roles, responsibilities, powers, and properties to keep the next president and the next tyrants to be to coming into office and saying, look, we're going to do these things, inflict these things upon you again. They can't do those things. But more importantly, the states need to stand up and say, you have no business doing these things, and we will not accept this anymore, period. That we're sovereign states, and we should have all of the resources available to us, our own land, you know, our ability to do whatever we think is best for us to survive. With that, then I would basically go into all applicable. So now remember, the National Guard and the National Air are deployed in all sorts of ways, right? They're deployed around the world. They're, you know, deployed right now, you know, to be, you know, the in-processing group on the border and so forth. All applicable National Guard currently in service, because see, when they're in service is when they're under federal ownership or custody. Now, see, this is where the National Guard actually, so does Congress call forth the militia anymore? No, no. This whole Dick Act of 1903 and the subsequent militia acts basically knocked out the protections that the states had over their militias. So in other words, we're going to get this right. We're going to actually get the militia right too. And all applicable National Guards currently in service will be redirected to either, because the one thing that the militia is supposed to do is supposed to repel invasions. So all those militia fighters that are deployed that are out of Texas, New Mexico, Arizona, and or California, and Florida, so anywhere that on a coastal region where you have, you know, the possible influx of boats, what have you, then we're going to make sure that all of their guardsmen, national air, national, you know, ground, all of them are returned and basically placed on and focused on repelling the invasion. That is going to be their only focus. And all other states where they have the National Guard or National Air Guard that is out deployed, they're going to return to their states, and their one focus is going to be repelling the invasion. Now, what we're going to do is we're going to stop and send the invaders right back to Mexico and say, you're not coming here. You can file to become an immigrant, and you can follow our laws to become an immigrant, but you're not coming into America until we actually put you on an immigration status. So we'll either push them, you know, from those border states because they're just right there. It's just a matter of just taking them down to the border, putting them on the other side and saying, don't come back. And, you know, having the force to keep them, keeping coyotes and all of these other folks from being able to come in. And so anybody that, and what we'll have to do is, well, unfortunately, folks, we're going to have to create a DMZ, a demilitarized zone. And so that DMZ is going to actually play, you know, we'll call it the dead man's land. Bottom line, anybody that, you know, tries to go into that, whether it be minefields or what have you, you're not going to, you know, have a good chance of surviving. So your desire to want to invade America must end. And as a matter of fact, this whole manipulation will be ended in our administration. We're going to make sure that no NGOs or no activity from the State Department is going to be playing these games to say, come here and we'll help you become a citizen. We'll hand out, you know, the goodness of America to you. I'm sorry. That's not how it's going to happen. It's going to happen legitimately. And actually, we're not only doing this. This is the kicker, that the people of those nations that have a high percentage of leaving and claiming refugees, oh, I'm a refugee, those nations will be offered the consideration of admission to the Union once they actually have an election to actually do so. So in other words, back in, let's say it's Guatemala, let's say it is Nicaragua, let's say it is El Salvador, let's say it's Venezuela. It doesn't matter. The people that vote, and they have a overwhelming majority, just not a mob rule, but we want to see at least a criteria of 60% or more of the people in an election that says, we want liberty and we want to be admitted into the United States. Then they will be, you know, will create a territory, will come in and will basically dismantle their existing government. It's just like a regular territory, and we will aid them in the transition of becoming a state. So every person that is in the United States that are not citizens yet will need to get their little happy butts back home so that they can get involved in their new form of government. And so we're actually going to dive into what this process is, because folks, this is so important in understanding this concept of admitting states into the Union. And so one of the things that as we're doing this, I will be advising the states that they may seriously want to consider an amendment to tie down the standards of admissions to the Union for new states to join the Union, which should require these following things. But how? Where do you find this? This is in Article 3, or Article 4, I mean, Section 3, and this is what it says. New states may be admitted by Congress into this Union, but no new state shall be formed or erected within the jurisdiction of any other state, nor any state be formed by the junction of two or more states without its consent, without the consent of the legislatures of the states concerned, as well as Congress. The Congress shall have the power to dispose of and make all needful rules and regulations respecting the territory, not the states, and other property belonging to the United States, and nothing in this Constitution be so construed as to prejudice any claims of the United States or any particular state in the Union or coming into the Union. So, and that last part I added, but bottom line, you're going to have to consider, because right here, there's no caveats. In other words, Congress can just boom, 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 boom. And so the states really need to actually consider tying down what these standards are. And I'm going to give you an example of what they should probably require. A high fluency in English, 75% or greater. If you want to make it 80%. But bottom line, there has to be a high fluency of English. Because you can't have a nation that actually can't communicate to each other as you traverse and have the freedom to go from one corner to the next. We all have to be able to speak. So they're going to have to, it doesn't mean they can't be bilingual, but they have to have, at least at a minimum, English. 75% of the people have to be fluent in English. The next part is 100% adoption of the regional breakdown of precinct and county structure. In other words, precincts for voting and counties as the sub-element of government, and that the county possess a full form of government. And what I mean by that is that the full form of government should require a legislative branch where you have your county commissioners or supervisors, an executive, whether that be a governor, whether that be a count, because it's a county, if you want to call it that. It's a label, that's a monarchical type of label, but I'm okay with governor. And a judiciary where you have a judge and or a group of judges. Because if your county is big enough where you can break down where you may have and need to have more than one judge, but you still only have one executive, you can have like I don't know if you'd want to have a Supreme Court, but nevertheless, I'm just saying that some counties, so maybe some counties should be split up. I don't know. because when we look at the shenanigans of happening in these heavily populated counties, you know, like what happens in Portland, what happened in King County in Seattle, L.A. County, Los Angeles. I mean, some of these counties were just way too big. Maybe they do need to be divided. Anyway, but, I don't want to get into those types of knickers. I just want to basically make sure that this framework is being adhered to, that when they come in, they will have county structure, that they will have a precinct within their counties or precincts and districts or what have you. That these new governments coming in will possess a bicameral legislature that will, because the reason we're doing this, folks, is not only to protect this, you know, this, the criteria of states coming into the union. We need to protect the framework of American republicanism, that we do not want any democracy or any other form of government. So we need to make sure that the states and their counties, the state government and their county government, you know, basically has a bicameral legislature. In other words, if you have a very heavily populated county, then the districts will have their own representatives. Not everybody should be elected at large, because when you allow elections at large, that means that the little bastions, because you're going to have bastions that will be really progressive, or they'll have their own little focus. And it's important that you have checks and balances. So to protect from massive democracy, you know, you need to break down based on population. And so one of the considerations would be, what would that population be in a county where you start dividing? Maybe it would be about 30 or 40,000, somewhere in there. Where if you've got a county of 200,000, then you should probably have maybe five districts of 40,000 each, or 30,000 each, and maybe six. Anyway, the whole point is to guarantee representation, appropriate, adequate representation for the individuals within that county. And so this bicameral legislature, both at the county and at the state level, will basically have the same thing as a state in Congress. In other words, their house represents the people of the county, and guaranteed at least, the county's guaranteed at least one representative at the state level and one representative at the district level. Now, if a district, you know, gets to a point where it exceeds what that representation is, then maybe they get two reps instead of one. Or, you know, you can always redistrict and redistrict and redistrict. Now, that's always fun because everybody wants to play in the redistricting game. And I don't understand that. I really don't understand. It's about respecting cultures. It's about respecting, you know, groups. But the reason why most people, you know, want to play in that is so that they can carve their way through what they call gerrymandering or pat. I just realized that I just ran out of time. So we will get back into this bicameral legislature. So we'll finish this off. We'll redo this again. And we'll take it off from here on our next Presidential Positions episode, which will be next Monday. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
Folks, I'm constantly providing you with case after case and giving you both the empirical information as well as irrefutable academic evidence that the federal government is operating well outside the bounds of the Constitution. In measuring outlays, the federal government is spending over 80% of your tax dollars on unconstitutional government. This is why we don't need a balanced budget amendment. We just need to enforce the Constitution. So what is it going to take for you to take a stand in getting the federal government back into the framework of the Constitution? To be clear, the solution is simple and does not require much work on any one individual, especially if everyone contributed to the effort. We only ask that you make a commitment today to contributing however you can and make the difference necessary for our posterity's sake. Send me an email at info@reclaimingtherepublic.org and let me know how you'd like to help so we can help you save our republic.